Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Hello, good people. It is time for episode 36 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show, and I got a pretty high-profile guest this week, Robert Drysdale. Before we get into the actual chat, as usual, guys, I have to remind you to please go and put a review up for the show on iTunes. That'll really mean a lot to me and helps get the show to more people. And also check out our sponsors. As always, Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood is offering you guys 10% off anything you buy in the store. That includes all of our gear and it includes our digital instructional material. So just head on over to store.jiu-jitsu-brotherhood.com and use the coupon code podcast at checkout and you'll get that discount. Also, truthnaturals.co.uk has some of the best CBD oil around. If you're in the UK, head on over to their site. Whatever you buy, just use the code JJBTruth and you'll get 10 quid off your order. So guys, coming up now is Robert Drysdale. Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show. We got another big time celebrity martial arts guest with us today. It's none other than multiple time ADCC, IBJJF and MMA champion Robert Drysdale. I'm so happy to have you on the show, Robert. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule.
Well, thanks for having me, Nick. It's a pleasure.
Cool, man. Well, I've got a lot of questions for you. You've been one of our most requested guests. The reason I decided to have you on the show is because I'm on this mailing list called Global Training Report, which is done by a guy called Roberto Pedrera. And I've been receiving it to my inbox. I don't know how I got on the mailing list, but I get it every few months. And he's always got interesting stories. And there was an article with you in it recently it's my understanding you're studying history. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so in this article, he references the fact that part of your thesis is studying the history of jiu-jitsu in Brazil, which I thought was really fascinating, not only because it's a fascinating topic, but it's not often that you hear about a high-level jiu-jitsu athlete like that who goes on to take an interest in something as cerebral and academic as the study of history. And it's my understanding you've gone back to college to pursue a bachelor's degree. Is that right?
Master's degree. I got my bachelor's in Brazil in 2017. And I always wanted to go back to school, but, I got sucked into the whole, the whole full-time jiu-jitsu practitioner, MMA fighter, MMA coach, gym owner, seminars. And I just wasn't allocating the time for my studies. So last year I went, I want to go back to school. This is something I've been craving for a long time. I really enjoy classes and learning. And there's that's cool. My academic interest actually predates my interest in combat, to be honest. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, I really feel like in a way I'm going back to my roots and I've been loving it so far. It's been great.
That's cool. Well, we're going to get into exactly what you're studying and a little bit more about your thesis. But before we get into that, Robert, the thing I find interesting about you is you're an American, but you also, you're half Brazilian, half American. Is that correct?
That is correct. My mother's Brazilian. My father's American. I was born in the United States, but I spent most of my formative years in Brazil.
Wow, that must be a total trip. Like spending, I know Roger's dad, Mauricio Gomez, he had a very similar experience, but the other way around, he grew up in Brazil until the age of about 15, and then he moved to the United States. So I'd be interested to know what the major differences you find between those two societies are, and more importantly, the major differences between the approach to jiu-jitsu training.
It's interesting because, from a very young age, I've always been exposed to two different cultures, two different languages, two different families with very different backgrounds. Spending, part of my childhood in the United States and, most of my childhood in Brazil, I grew up in the Mormon faith. So, I've always been around missionaries and, Americans visiting. My father would bring me to the United States every now and then to visit. So I've always been split between both cultures. And, what came from that wasn't so much a preference for this culture or that culture, but mostly an understanding of difference and being able to analyze things from a different perspective and, just look at the world in a different way. So even with the language thing, right, you think of a term and you can't really translate it. So it kind of forces you to look at that same concept under a different light, because you can't always translate, you know, some of these concepts. So, you know, there are things about the Brazilian culture that I have a hard time explaining to Americans. So, for example, there's this word, if you're Brazilian, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's called malandro. And you can't translate it in English. It's very, very difficult to translate, but it is a huge part of Brazilian culture. It's all over jiu-jitsu. You watch Brazilian practitioners compete, and you see malandragem everywhere. Like, it's something I never had to explain to my students in Brazil. They got it right away. They knew exactly what I was talking about. And when I teach in the United States, I have a hard time explaining to people, because it's a concept very so much ingrained in the Brazilian culture, right? So malandragem would be something like, you know, someone who manages to, you know, steer the rules or circumstances in his favor in somewhat of a deceitful way, without exactly breaking the rules, but right on the border and doing with elegance, right? Most people in the West would look at that and they would go, "Oh, it's dishonesty." A Brazilian looks at that as like, "Oh, this is a sign of intelligence."
That's right? Interesting. So,
yeah, it's very ingrained in the culture. You can't translate the term. Like, it's very, very much part of, and not just jiu-jitsu. This is across the board, from politics down to your, you know, like, you know, you kind of, as soon as your boss is looking away, you kind of take a little break and, you know, act like nothing's happening. As soon as he looks back, you get back to work, that thing, right?
Do you think that's part of the reason Brazil is like still a third world country?
I think it's one reason. I mean, there are a number of reasons, right? It's something that, you know, Brazilian history is so complex. You don't want to generalize and make it that simplistic, but I think that's an element. I actually believe that element played a role in the development of jiu-jitsu. You know, I think jiu-jitsu tends to be a highly, you know, creative art for some of the reasons that I'm describing. Like, Brazilians are very ingenious when it comes to, you know, dealing with new circumstances and improvising on the spot and using of malandragem to get their way. And when I look at, you know, jiu-jitsu, how a match develops, like, I don't see things happening according to plan. What I see is improvisation every step along the way and the use of malandragem to get your way. I think it's one thing that you see it's very different from the traditional Japanese approach to martial arts, right? And Brazilians, I feel that they have that, now that there's that element of Brazilian culture that you see that's very present in the development of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And under certain circumstances, it can be positive, but it's a bit of a problem. Like, the origin of this problem, like, will be, it's very complex, very interesting topic to discuss. But
I'd love to hear a bit more about the origin, if you know of it.
It has to. I mean, as far as like where this comes from in Brazil, I think it began with, you know, first of all, the, you know, have to go back to the colonization of Brazil. I suppose there's a very good book, by the way, if anyone's interested in understanding the Brazilian people. There's no book I would recommend more than Darcy Ribeiro, O Povo Brasileiro, The Brazilian People. You could buy it on Amazon. It's called The Brazilian People by Darcy Ribeiro. And he's a famous Brazilian anthropologist, absolutely in love with the country. And he talks about the formation of the country from an anthropological perspective. Mm-hmm. And he, you can see the passion for the country. But the way he explains the country is, you know, when the first Portuguese, they get to Brazil, they're not interested in, you know, bringing their families. They're not interested in settling a home there. They're interested in basically two things: resources and women, right? That's what they're there for. You know, they want the money. They want to make their money quickly, and they're interested in the native women. So, you know, the first, you know, raping of the country occurs not only materially, but it occurs literally, of raping of native women, you know, left, right, and center. And what is born from that is not, you know, he's not European. He's not native either. He's Brazilian, but he also doesn't have an identity, because it doesn't fit in one world or the other. Mm-hmm. Right. So Darcy Ribeiro talks about the formation of the country under that light. And, you know, what comes from that is largely a country that till this day doesn't quite have an identity. It's not quite European, and it's not quite native. It's not quite African. There's the African element that comes on later on. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, my Brazilian friends may get mad when I say this, but I think Darcy Ribeiro is like the most enthusiastic about his country that I can think of. And he makes the case that it's a country that to some degree still lacks a national identity. And you see this in the United States, for example, when, you know, just a contrast, in the first, English come to the United States, right, come to the Americas, they bring their families. They're bringing seeds. They plan on staying, right? So the dynamic they develop there is very, very different. So the first generation, you know, they're English. Second generation, they're English. Third generation, fourth generation, they're like, we're not English, we're Americans. And they create this sense of identity that is very, very present. I mean, it screams at you. Like, people from all over the world come to the United States, and they, like, it stands out, like, how much of a national identity the United States possesses. And I think that plays a huge role in how a country goes on to develop. Like, this is just, like, scraping the surface here. We're speaking very broadly. But it's, you know, and it trickles down from there, you know. And I think it has to do with the early beginnings. And from then onwards, in Brazil, you have this, and it's a Latin American problem. It's not just a Brazilian problem. You have this elitist problem where some people really feel that they, you know, like, I'm European, I'm white, I'm kind of rank higher than you, right? Like, they won't even let their kids go to the same nightclubs and bars as someone who is poor, for example. Like, this is something that if you're American or European, you go to Brazil, it just jumps at you right away. You'll see it right away. But if you're Brazilian, you don't see it. You think it's completely normal, right? And it's so part of the culture, like, people don't even see it. Like, it's not even a thing. Whereas the United States, yeah, it's very fascinating. You if you go to any bar or any nightclub in the United States, you can have rich people and poor people, and they dress, you know, similar ways. They listen to the same music. They don't really, you know, identify themselves as you're rich, I'm poor. That sort of class thing is less prevalent in the United States as it is in Brazil. Whereas in Brazil, you look at someone and you immediately don't recognize them as part of your social class. So therefore, we cannot be friends. We cannot hang out.
Yeah.
And I know this because I grew up better off than most people in Brazil, right? We were better than average. With that being said, I lived in a very poor neighborhood, right? That's where we bought our house in, like, you know, somewhat of a ghetto, but I was, like, probably the richest kid in the whole ghetto.
Okay.
And my parents, because they taught English, you know, they had access to people of a social class that, you know, were wealthy because they were able to pay for English classes, right? So some of my friends were very wealthy. You know, their parents would buy them a BMW the day they turned 18. And I had other friends who were, you know, like, every now and then I have to give them clothes. They had nothing to wear to go to school type thing, right? Oh. So I was exposed to both these worlds. And, you know, it just from the very beginning, it screamed. Even from a young age, I was very aware of this. And it's funny how, like, most Brazilians are not aware of this problem, but it's almost like there are two countries inside Brazil. Mm-hmm. There's them and there's us. And I think that is as big as a problem as Brazilians' early colonization. But this elitist problem that exists in Brazil till today is a huge problem. And I don't know if they've ever solved it. They've been trying to solve it for a while.
Yeah.
Century, and it's very present in politics.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Robert. I mean, it reminds me, I've been to Brazil a couple of times, and it reminded me so much of where I'm from, which is South Africa.
Yeah.
In particular, the huge gap between the people who have and the people who don't have.
It's
a totally different experience. Well, those are two totally different experiences of life. I mean, the middle and upper class white people, those who have, they live generally Western first world lifestyles, and everyone else, I mean, they're just scraping to get by. And it's Americans that don't, I think even the poor Americans here, it's a totally different level of poverty to the poor Brazilians or the poor South Africans or the poor Mexicans even. And I don't think many people in Western Europe and the United States can kind of really comprehend just how little those people have and how difficult life is for them.
No, I couldn't agree more. You know, it's interesting. I see people complain about poverty in the U.S. and have an Xbox at home.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have an Xbox at home, you're not poor. It's free.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, the level of poverty here is real, but it's not. I mean, I hate when I, like, sometimes I'm listening to, like, rap songs and they're talking about how hard their lives is and they're from the ghetto and this and that, and I'm going, you don't even know what a ghetto looks like, man. Like, you grew up in the richest country in the world. You're clueless as to what a ghetto looks like. You might have seen it on Discovery Channel or something, but you've never, you know what I'm saying? It's like, so there's this element of almost like, I feel that people have it so good in the United States, they don't realize how easy life is over here. And I mean this as a compliment, it really is, but I think that being sheltered from reality has really, in a sense, has been, you know, it's good for people that live here, obviously, but in a way, it's kind of made us Americans a little spoiled and unaware of how the rest of the world lives.
Mm-hmm, you said it. So you've obviously established your credentials as a historian, giving us that really brief but really informative breakdown of the history of Brazil. So I'd like to shift the conversation towards the history of jiu-jitsu. Now, you know, the history of jiu-jitsu as we're presented it is that a Japanese jiu-jitsu / judo player called Mitsuru Maeda, if I'm not mistaken, or the Count Koma, as they refer to him, he arrived in Brazil in the early 20th century, and he taught some of Gestao Gracie's sons, Gestao Gracie being a prominent lawyer, he taught some of his sons jiu-jitsu in exchange for legal advice, and that's what spawned the Gracie family dynasty, dynasty of jiu-jitsu. Now, I had always just believed this because that's what we're presented with, and there's not much else. There are no competing theories or histories. And then the same person, Roberto Pedrera, in his global training report, he shared a few years ago, he started to share his alternative histories. And it blew my mind that, what we're told might not be true. It might be a completely different, jiu-jitsu might be a completely different thing that came to us in a completely different manner. And I'd love to know a little bit more about what you found so far regarding this.
Well, first of all, the work that inspired me to actually start researching this was Roberto Pedrera's Shockey. Right? I remember seeing Shockey on the French shelf years ago. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I had no idea that the history of jiu-jitsu had something that was so, academically oriented and so, such a serious work. But I kind of just you forgot about it for a while. And like recently, maybe a year and a half ago, I was asked by a student, I remember well when it happened, why I didn't have a picture of Carlton Helio. And I told him I never bothered learning about a picture of Carlton Helio on the gym's wall, right? Like most gyms. And it wasn't a disrespect to them, obviously, but it was more of a matter of skepticism. Like, I don't know anything about it. I'm not going to, I like to learn about it before I actually go on, putting pictures on my wall. And that's when I bought Shockey. I bought it. It's on Amazon. Everyone should read it. It's a heavy read. It's not a light read. But it's highly informative and it's very serious work, and it's the best work out there to date. And that's what inspired me to start researching into this. And I've done my own digging through the Brazilian National Library and just going through sources, was able to find a thing or two that was somewhat new as far as this research goes. But there's this whole underground community of Brazilian researchers that they've been, some of them researching this for like 10, 15 years. And they know a lot. They just, most of them are never published, but they actually know a lot. I mean, since the Brazilian National Library digitalized the files in 2013, this information is kind of like it's coming to surface now, because now we have access to the newspapers of the time, whereas before we only had access to, Carlos's Gracie testimony. And if you read, for example, if you read Hala's biography, if you read, Enzo Gracie's book with John Danaher, right? If you read the Hoyler Gracie and Kid Peligro book, they're all making all these claims about the history of jiu-jitsu. But if you pay close attention, none of them have any citations. There's a reason why they don't put sources there. They don't have them, right? Everything comes down to Carlos Gracie's testimony. That's what it all comes back to, right? So Carlos Gracie told us the story. And a lot of it is just, it's mostly, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying he's a lie. To the contrary, I think it's mostly accurate. There's some misconceptions, some omissions. A lot of it probably just, his memory just failed him. He was probably asked the story when he was in his 60s and he couldn't remember. He was, you got to remember, like what his, whatever practice he had in Belém do Pará at the time, he would have been, around 17 years old. 15 to 17 years old, right? That's what we're talking about here. So, you ask, if I ask you something, Nick, like something happened 20, 30 years ago in your life, you may not remember it well. Imagine 60 years later or whatever, right? So, now we're able to go back, trace back to Japanese immigration, how it happened. And what came to surface was there were a lot more characters that were very significant, very important to the development of jiu-jitsu in Brazil than no one has ever heard of, including members of the Gracie family. And that's why, to me, it was like, I think pretty much what we heard came to us from Carlos and later through Jorge and Gracie. And I feel that, both those sides of the family, they told their story, and it's central. No one can ever take that. Carlos and Helio are central to the development of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but there were others, and part of my research is kind of just trying to, give these guys their due credit and bring them back to life. I feel that they were important for the sport we love so much.
Could you tell us a little bit about a few of them, or a couple of them even?
Okay, so a few characters that people have never heard of, right? So Maeda was not the first Japanese to teach in Brazil. He could be claimed to be the first judoka to teach jiu-jitsu in Brazil. Like that's a fair statement. He was not the first jiu-jitsu practitioner. We know of one through secondary sources. I have been unable to find a primary source to this. And I was just in Brazil about a month ago, and we went to the Japanese Museum, or the Nippo Jap Brazilian Museum of Japanese Immigration, whatever it's called. And, I couldn't find the primary. We found the secondary source that claims that a man called Takezo Manji was teaching jiu-jitsu in Brazil in 1888. He was hired by the Brazilian Emperor, Dom Pedro II, to teach jiu-jitsu to the military. And That would have been, I mean, assuming that is correct, that would have been the first Japanese to teach jiu-jitsu in Brazil. This is in 1888, but jiu-jitsu in Brazil doesn't start picking up momentum later until the circuses come about. And it wasn't just jiu-jitsu, it was also catch wrestling, Greco-Roman wrestling. You know, so there's all these other martial arts that are playing a part, and it mostly comes from the circus. Maeda was relevant because he was somewhat famous, right? But in fact, there were jiu-jitsu was already going in Brazil prior to Maeda getting there. We know of at least one Brazilian who was teaching jiu-jitsu in Brazil in 1913. This is a year before Maeda arrives in Brazil. And he's Brazilian, right? So to say that, you know, Maeda introduced, you know, jiu-jitsu in Brazil is a little unfair. Although he was certainly, you know, the one with the most notoriety. And, I mean, the press referred to him as a world champion. There's no world championship at the time, obviously. But because he had competed all over the world, right? Did, you know, judo demonstrations all over the world. They called him a world champion. But Maeda was relevant for a number of reasons. He, you know, we know of him through Carlos Gracie. I think Carlos Gracie might have been Hobson Gracie in one of the interviews we did for our film. He talked about, like, if it weren't for my father, no one would have ever heard of Maeda. And I'm like, that's true. That's accurate. You know, Maeda was, he was brought to life because of the Gracie family. But there are others, you know, that played a very significant role. There were obviously, like I mentioned, Japanese that were teaching there prior. There are people like Gio Mori, who was an early friend and then rival of the Gracie family. He's extremely relevant. There were people in Belém do Pará, you know, like Jacinto Ferro and Donato Pires dos Reis, who were instrumental in not only the early days of jiu-jitsu in Belém do Pará and then later in, you know, Minas Gerais and Rio de Janeiro. But, you know, very likely they actually taught Carlos Gracie jiu-jitsu as well. They were very likely to be, you know, ranking above Carlos Gracie and you know, in Belém do Pará. So, you know, we wanted to tell their story because we feel that, you know, look, for something like Brazilian jiu-jitsu to happen, a number of things had to align. Like, it wasn't one of those things that, you know, it just happened. It's the only way it could have happened. A number of things had to align. And we feel that these characters played a role. My favorite case is George Gracie, was a Gracie that most people have never heard of. Mm-hmm. Like, if you ask the average jiu-jitsu practitioner, they never heard of George Gracie. George Gracie is arguably the father of modern MMA, right? He was the guy that was fighting anyone, anytime, anywhere, under any set of rules. You know, but, you know, he's a guy that kind of got, you know, pushed aside because he's a bit of a rebel in the family. He's a black sheep in the family. He wouldn't, you know, he was, you know, had a little bit of rivalry with Carlos and Helio, and he had a good relationship with the Luta Livre guys, and he had a good relationship with the Japanese, and he was more of a, you know, like a, you couldn't control him. Yeah, he was his own person, you know, but because of that.
He sounds instantly like my favorite. Just hearing that, he sounds like he would have been my favorite.
No, I think most people would. Like, he came across that way to me as well. Like, because he was a very jolly character. You could see he liked the good life. He wasn't worried about lineages. He wasn't worried about the future. You really got to give Carlos and Helio credit for that, for really, you know, looking that far ahead and thinking about lineages, right? There's a reason why they had so many kids. But, you know, George wasn't thinking about that. George was traveling the country and fighting as much as he could. He's arguably the most experienced Gracie to today when it came to fighting. Like, this guy was fighting every weekend. Granted, a lot of his fights were fake. That was completely normal at the time. Everyone was doing it. And George didn't, you know. He did fake fights. He was fighting for money. But he was the kind of guy that, you know, for example, Helio would like, oh, I'm going to fight you with no points. And your gi has to be of this length. And, you know, it has to be no time limit or long rounds. And he was very picky about who, you know, and how we fought. George was the kind of guy, he went along and go, you do whatever you want to do. I'll do whatever I want to do. You wear whatever you want to wear. I'll wear whatever I want to wear. Let's fight. That's right, cool. That was George. Yeah. And in a way, he kind of, you know, it's hard to say what the birth of Valetudo was, but I guess, you know, Pedrero mentions this fight as the arguably the first Valetudo fight in Brazil was a fight between Chico Soledade and George Gracie. Mm-hmm. And this was like straight out, like anything goes. I mean, granted, there were cross fights prior to that. Like, there were already some cross fighting going on in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And the rules kind of went, you know, according to, you know, they had a meeting the day before and they decided the rules on the spot. There was no federation or regulation or commission. They were kind of winging it in a lot of ways. And, you know, I just feel that their story hasn't been told. And it's kind of like, well, it doesn't sound like, you know, the history hasn't been fair. Mm-hmm. With them. You know, and history has that thing. It could be extremely unfair with some people and, you know, give some people too much credit. And not so the goal of the film is never to the research is never to take away from anyone. It's more to, you know, shed some light on what really happened.
That's great. I mean, so many things come to mind that I want to talk to you about. But before I just want the listeners to know, you said you're making a film surrounding the real history of Brazil, of jiu-jitsu in Brazil. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, so basically, once I started researching, and the more I research, I mean, I'm reading Pedrera, and I'm going like, there's no point in redoing what this guy's already done, right? Like, it's done. It's well done. You know, I'd still like to write something in the future. I think I can, and it's just, but you know, it won't be as in depth as what Pedrera did. So, but at the same time, like I knew like two or three people who had bought Shockey and they hadn't finished it. And they're like, you know, it's too heavy of a read. And mm-hmm. you know how people are with books. They look at the size of the book and they get intimidated, or, you know, if it's not a novel, people aren't always, it's too factual, right? We're talking numbers and names and dates, and it could be a heavy read for a lot of people. But at the same time, I felt it was such an incredible story that had to be told. So I had the idea, we're part of a generation that, well, I mean, people won't even watch a 3-minute YouTube video. Mm-hmm. If you send them a link and it's longer than a minute, people won't watch it. You know how it is. So mm-hmm. people are less likely to spend a lot of time reading a book. But I feel that if we put a film together that portrayed this story, you know, and basically try to tell, you know, the story as honestly and right down the middle as possible, right? I think that people would be interested. Like, all jiu-jitsu practitioners would be interested in watching a 90-minute film on how jiu-jitsu developed in Brazil. Mm-hmm. So that's when I had the idea, and I've basically spent the last, you know, like, well, as soon as I had that idea, maybe 9 months, just looking for someone to fund the film. And we had a number of different ideas of how to raise money for this, but I finally went to ACB, which ACB Jiu-Jitsu, the Chechen organization, and I sat down with Meyer Bekasiev, and I told him about the project and about the research and about what we were trying to do. And he didn't even let me finish. Like, before I was done, like, presenting like the business plan, he was like, you know, let's do it. That's so great. We were very fortunate to find funding through them. And they've been great for jiu-jitsu. And I really feel that this, what we're doing now, is something that is going to be archival and something that will fantastic. Be referenced in the future. Like, we are, my, you know, winning jiu-jitsu tournaments is fun, but at the end of the day, you know, you're not really doing anything for jiu-jitsu when you win a tournament. It's mostly for yourself, you know. But I really feel that, you know, this film is something that will impact the jiu-jitsu community for the better. And
yeah, I can't wait to see it. I'll be first in line to watch it.
Well, yeah, we're almost done with interviews. We got like maybe one interview left, and then some reenactments and some post production. You know, the goal is to release before the end of the year, but mm-hmm. it's hard to say.
Yeah, Robert, that sounds fantastic. That's an awesome initiative. And I was just reminded when you were speaking, you know, the Gracie family, like my coach is Roger Gracie, or the guy who gave me my black belt is Roger Gracie. And I love the guy. I don't have a bad word to say about him. But like within the family, there are some elements that, I don't know, that people might call them questionable when it comes to their actions. And also, there's a lot of hype. I mean, I remember reading about that fight between Kimura and Elio Gracie. And if I'm not mistaken, it was made out to be that, like, Elio, like, held this bigger, stronger opponent off using, like, superior technique, but he eventually succumbed to the power of the weight advantage of Kimura. And I just, for the first time, we put some footage of that fight up on our Facebook page. And man, I mean, it wasn't close. It wasn't even.
Yeah.
It was borderline not even a fight. It was a whipping. It just made me realize there's different sides to the story that we've been told.
Yeah, I think the first thing when people talk about the first, there's no such thing as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu without the Gracie family. End of story. Right? No one can ever take that. But again, when you talk about Gracie family, it's like you're talking about a single individual. Now, you're talking about hundreds of people here. Mm-hmm. Some of them have been actually detrimental to Jiu-Jitsu, if you ask me. Some of them done far more harm to jiu-jitsu than good, mm-hmm. right? But, like, there are people that did – like, Carlos and Healy are central, obviously, but Carlos and Gracie was central. Holes Gracie was central. You know, Carlos Gracie Jr. referred to Holes as the first athlete in jiu-jitsu. I think that's appropriate. I think it's a good term. I mean, from the sound of it, from reading his – you know, knowing what we know about him, it sounded like this guy was a step ahead of everyone else, willing to learn wrestling and sambo and really train like an athlete. So there are people that are very influential, but like, we can't really generalize, you know. Some, you know, some of them never even trained jiu-jitsu. They're not even, you know, interested in it. Yeah.
That's
but,
true.
You know, regarding the Helio fight, you know, it's interesting because, you know, first off, I'm not going to remember exactly Kimura's weight, but I know that under certain places will exaggerate his weight. He was heavier than Helio, but not that much heavier. Like, a lot of times people would really exaggerate his weight. He was not unusual in Japan at that time as a grappler. They made it sound like he was the best grappler in Japan. And, you know, from all we know, is like, no, there are a lot of guys as good as him. He was not unusual. He was a good. He was one elite grappler in Japan. but not the most dominant guys. We know of people that went toe-to-toe with him in the gym. We heard this from the Kosen Judo guys in Japan during the interviews, right? And they're like, no, Kimura was just – he was relevant. He was good, but not like – he wasn't the king of kings.
So you heard this directly. You went to Japan. And
yes, we were just in Japan. We spoke to Kodokan. We spoke to – and two Kosen Judo practices at universities, right? Kyoto and Tokyo University. And we interviewed the teachers and one historian. And, yeah, they have a lot to say.
That's great. Wow, that's fascinating. Well, Robert, I know you're a busy guy, and I'm thoroughly grateful. That was a great interview. I enjoyed your perspectives and your knowledge as well. And I think you're doing a really cool thing for Jiu-Jitsu making this film. If the listeners want to find out about more about the film or your gym or anything else that you're putting out there, where should they go?
Well, we haven't really started much promotion when it comes to the film yet. Like, I'm not too worried about that right now. We have an Instagram page.
Okay.
At Closed Guard the Movie. And that's, and then we have a Facebook page as well. Same name, right? Closed Guard the Movie. Okay. And, you know, we can follow some of the updates. I update pictures like every other day, like telling a little bit about the story and about who we're talking to and what we're trying to do. We really just want to, you know, complete history of jiu-jitsu. That was the goal from the beginning, and I think we're going to be able to do that. The footage turned out to be better than we were expecting. We have some amazing interviews, amazing sound bites, incredible b-roll. I think the film should be a combination of something that's highly informative and aesthetically pleasing at the same time, which is a very difficult balance to strike in documentary films, by the way. You know, yeah, I'm a historian. I'd lean towards information, but I have my camera crew, they're really into like the entertainment side of things. Mm-hmm. And I think once we find that balance, it's going to be a really cool film. I'm super excited. I'm probably the most excited person of this whole about this project. So this has been great.
Thank you so much, Robert. And I'll chat to you again soon. I'm sure we're going to be able to do another episode at one point in the future, because it sounds like you have way more to share.
Anytime, Nick. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, hit me up anytime. I'd love to.
Okay, my brother. Keep the faith. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
So I didn't really know Robert Drysdale at all before I did that interview. I'd obviously heard of him because he's got a really good competitive career, but I hadn't heard too many reports on the kind of person he was. And after speaking with him, it's clear that he's definitely a good dude, which is not always the case for someone that accomplished. And what I really respected about him is the fact that he's retired as a fighter, but instead of resting on his laurels, he's diving headfirst into a whole new career and still managing to tie that back to the art. He's becoming a historian and a filmmaker, which is very, very cool. I highly recommend, if you have the time, to check out the Global Training Report website as well. It's by the gentleman Roberto Pedrera, I think the name is, if I'm not mistaken. And he's the guy who brought up a lot of the stuff about the historical narrative of jiu-jitsu perhaps not being as accurate as we thought it was. He's got some really cool stories of training in gyms in Brazil back in the day. I used to read that site when I was a blue belt, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So check out Global Training Report. You'll just do a Google and you'll be able to find it quite easily. Hope you guys enjoyed the show, and peace out.